his book, but the younger people will know him from that. Many of us have known him for a very long time as somebody who was inspiring and a bit scary. If I can say it, Michael has always been the person that you took an idea to when you thought it was a good enough idea to get it killed. And but then he would also very generously help you put it back together. At least that was my experience since graduate school. Recently, in a certain blog, he was referred to as the guru of physics. And we're very, very happy to have him here. He's done many, many things, from formal parts of physics, like string theory and string field theory, to very phenomenological, real particle physics, when particle physics was particle physics and will be soon again. And we're very pleased to have him here to tell us about dark matter from a physical perspective.
Can you give us those things?
Sure. No.
I'm pleased to be here. After reading about the perimeter for many years, it's amazing to actually come here. And I thank you folks very much for the invitation. Am I talking loud enough for the people in the back here?
Yes, there is actually a microphone. We forgot to wire you up. Do you want me to
get on board?
There usually is a microphone. Okay, go ahead.
Okay.
What it means is, here it is.
Uh-oh.
I found it, and what it means, if we switch it on, is that it's going to be recorded for posterity.
Oh, God.
Okay. So, for posterity, I would like to again for inviting me to this place. I'm going to talk about the topic that's listed here, a particle physicist's perspective on dark matter. I apologize to especially those of you in quantum information theory that for the life of me, I couldn't figure out what is the correct level for a PI theoretical colloquium. So some parts of this may be a little technical for people who are not knowledgeable about supersymmetry and its applications to quantum physics. If that is the case, it's a small room. Raise your hand, and we'll get it straight. There's nothing in this conference. First of all, I'd like to thank a number of people who've been trying to educate me on this subject. I guess my role in this is that a lot of people work, and then I try and guru-iate or whatever I'm supposed to do. In particular, this work is a part of a report which was commissioned from a group of people headed by Jonathan Feng and Mark Trautman about how cosmology in general connects with things that are coming in particles. And the last two guys, Ted Baltz and Andreas Birkendahl, are people who are very knowledgeable about dark matter and also helping with some of these things. Our sponsor is this thing, which I probably should tell you a little about. In the United States, there has now come a consensus that the next great accelerator project should be one of these, a linear plus or minus collider of total length, I think, 50 kilometers. It's about 20 kilometers of accelerating structure made of these amazing superconducting cavities. The center of mass energy for the first stage would be 500 GeV in the center of mass. It's a very expensive machine. It's a multi-billion dollar project. So people would very much like to know what to do with it. One of the things what I mean by that is outside the pure particle physics point of view of trying to explore to shorter distances, what applications does that have to other fields of science? And an obvious one, and one which is, I thought when I started this quite well understood, is the application to cosmology, and in particular to Darwin. But as we thought about it, that turned out to be a very rich subject. And so I'll try and present to you what I think is a somewhat novel perspective of Darwin that I hope you appreciate. So first of all, what is Darwin? Oh, could we have the lights, did you? What is Darwin? Well, actually, astrophysicists have known for a long time, and in fact since the 1930s, that most of the energy of the universe that gravitates is not carried by stars, gas, or anything observable. It's carried by some unobservable stuff. And part of that stuff is matter. Part of it, as we now know, is dark energy or cosmological constant. But the parts of it that are matter are quite interesting, because especially the particle physicists who are supposed to be able to tell you what that stuff is. So the fact that it exists and it is outside our current framework is for us a quite large problem. I'm not going to tell you a lot about why we believe dark matter exists. This slide is a kind of iconography of dark matter. Dark matter is seen in the rotation curves of galaxies, of which I've shown an example in the top of the slide. The fact that whereas in the solar system, velocities fall off a point of the square root of r. In galaxies, when you measure distant stars that rotate around galaxies, clusters, or even hot gas, the velocities do not fall off, but rather approach roughly constant, maybe slowly increasing values. This is a particularly interesting example. This lady, Vera Rubin and her colleagues, actually measured the rotational velocity about here at 40 kiloparsecs from the center of the galaxy, using the fact that the rotating gas there was illuminated by a background quasar. And in fact, it follows this curve up instead of going down. This fellow is Fritz Wicki, who in 1933 calculated the mass of the Coma cluster by applying the virial theorem to the observed velocities. He found the value 100 times larger than he expected. A modern version of that analysis done by the Princeton group is shown here, and it says that about a third of the total energy content of the universe is in matter, whereas if you just count stars and look at how much gas you have, it's about an order of magnitude smaller. So we also have very strong evidence that most of the matter that we're talking about is non-baryonic. And that comes from studies of primordial nuclear synthesis, and more recently from the cosmic microwave background. So recently, in particular, from the WMAP experiment and the Space Telescope observations that fix the Hubble scale, we now have some confidence. I mean, confidence in the sense that you can put meaningful errors on these numbers, that we understand what fraction of the energy density of the universe comes from these various sources. So with a mega equals one being the dimensionless measure of energy density that would correspond to a flat Robertson-Walker universe, the baryons are 4%, the dark matter is 20%, and then this cosmological constant or dark energy actually is more like 75%. So we understand this one. We don't understand these two. For this one, I must simply apologize that I do not know any reasonable theory that I would like to present to this audience. But for this one, I think there is a lot to say, both from the point of view of theory and from the point of view of experiment. And in particular, there is a variety of underground and cosmic ray experiments that now are trying to look for this kind of matter and to try to get some evidence, direct evidence that it's there by particles coming out of the universe and trying to figure out what it is. So with that background, which again is really not the topic of this colloquium, but I hope it's the topic of the colloquium that folks have had here. I'd like to now go on to the real subject, which is, okay, I'm not an astronomer, I'm not engaged in cosmic ray experiments. I'm a particle physicist, and my main interest, as I've already explained to you, is future experiments that we will do at large high-energy accelerators. So why and how is that relevant to this problem? Can astrophysicists solve this problem all by themselves? And my answer is that I think that actually something is missing, both from that question and from, in fact, most of the discussion of dark matter that you see both in the particle physics and the astrophysics literature. So there's a quote here from a recent review paper by Bertoni, Hooper, and Silk, which gives an example. So this says, a typical example of the strong interplay between particle physics, theoretical physics, cosmology, and astrophysics. From one side, theoretical particle physics stimulates the formulation of new theories, predicting new particles that turn out to be excellent dark matter. On the other side, cosmological and astrophysical observations constrain the properties of such particles and consequently the parameters of new theories. So what's wrong with this? Well, clearly, there's something in the middle which is left out, namely, directly going to short distances with particle physics experiments, learning what's there, and bringing that information back into the subject. And this is something that is a long tradition in astrophysics. I remind you that the two fellows that I pictured here got their training as nuclear structure physicists, found that information tremendously valuable in trying to figure out how stars work. And toward the, right to the end of his life, Lowy Fowler maintained a laboratory at Caltech that he used to directly measure low-energy nuclear cross-sections that were relevant to the creation of elements of stars, and eventually also the primordial nuclear synthesis. So what we'd like to ask is, will there be a similar interplay between microscopic physics and the physics of the large and the study of dark matter? And how could that work? Now, I'd like to remind you that even though the existence of dark matter and its cosmic value on large scales is very well established, there's still many problems, astrophysical problems, connected to dark matter. The theory of cold dark matter, that is the idea that dark matter is a non-relativistic particle moving under gravity, interacting with other forms of matter only through gravity, does a beautiful job of explaining why galaxies form from primordial fluctuations, and determining the power spectrum of objects that we see about down to galactic size. Below that, there's tremendous controversy. And that controversy has to do with the kinds of questions that I've just asked. In cold dark matter theories, galaxies the size of our galaxy assemble themselves from smaller components. And the remnants, the fossils of those things, may still be around. Computer codes are not sufficiently powerful to tell whether they're disrupted or not. And to a great extent, it's an experimental question. Do we find dark companions, dark dwarf companions of the Milky Way? Do we find subhalos, which are local densities of dark matter within the Milky Way? How fast does the dark matter distribution peak at the galactic center? Is dark matter on small scales clumping? And could there be, for example, local extreme maxima, or maybe caustics and trajectories that would cause large extreme concentrations of dark matter? In principle, you should answer these questions by going out and looking for such things. But the looking brings up new problems, of which this slide gives the simplest example. So here I've written the formula for the cosmic gamma ray flux that would come from dark matter annihilation. The dark matter particles are distributed in the galaxy. Every once in a while, two of them come together. They annihilate. They annihilate in general into some general hadrons or leptons, which often, especially if they're pi zeros, will decay to gamma rays. So there's a particle physics cross-section that comes in here, the differential cross-section for producing gamma rays of a certain energy from the dark matter annihilation. Then there's also a question of how large the radius. So for that, you need a flux computation, which brings in the local density of dark matter. And then you would convolve those together to determine the signal that you would try and observe for example, at a Gamma-ray observatory. Now, the problem is that both of these factors have uncertainties that are many orders of magnitude. The uncertainties in this factor I've already tried to explain. They come from the questions, the actual issues in astrophysics that I've listed on the previous slide. The uncertainties in this I'm going to try to make clear in this talk. And to a great extent, the goal of this talk is to somehow resolve these uncertainties so that we can do experiments to figure out where the dark matter is and what kind of stuff it actually is. Now, the problem of trying to take only this and determine both elements of the right-hand side is ill-posed. But it also has more of a danger, because the other thing about these experiments is that they're known to be extremely challenging. The rates are low, very exotic equipment is needed, and the signals are hard to determine from various kinds of galactic, in this case gamma ray, or positron backgrounds. And so in that situation, there's a temptation to treat every anomaly as a discovery, basically by cranking up both sides of the equation to the maximum possible level. So then you have to ask yourself, well, if someone reports an anomaly, can you believe that there's something there? Well, I think you can believe it much better if at least half of this equation is under control from another source. And so I'm going to try and explain to you how we're going to do that. So can particle physics experiments help? Well, unfortunately, over the past 20 years, there's been a lot of noise, but particle physics experiments have not been of much use. We've been increasing the energy that we can access in collider experiments, but we haven't yet reached the scale which is apparently relevant to the production of this stuff. However, it seems that that will really change soon, because all estimates for the Large Hadron Collider at CERN say that it will have energies well above the natural scales of dark matter in a wide variety of ways. And so, looking ahead, we can think that there some definite information. And then, looking beyond those experiments, I think it's interesting to ask the question of how we can really complete this program of providing to astronomers looking for dark matter in galaxies the tools that they need to interpret the various probes that they do. So here is then finally the outline of the talk. I'd like to tell you why, in particular, WIMP dark matter is something that deserves special attention. And it's something that I'm going to concentrate on throughout the rest of the talk. I'm going to tell you why the LHC should not only observe dark matter, but actually it should be more or less the first thing you learn in the universe. It should be a huge physics thing. I'm going to tell you that why, despite this, the LHC is insufficient, and essentially what we need in order to complete the program that it will be doing. I'm going to talk a little about microscopic predictions of the dark matter cosmic density, which then will be compared to astrophysical calculations of that density. And then finally, we'll go back and talk about the astrophysical detection of cosmic dark matter. So here we go. So first of all, WIMPs. I'm a fan of WIMPs. Why is that? Well, the first thing I have to tell you, for those of you who have not yet dipped into this field or have just dipped your toe into it, is that everyone who talks about dark matter has their own favorite candidate over a very wide range. Dark matter, aside from the answers, as I say, controversial answers to those questions that I posed earlier, is observed to interact with other forms of matter only gravitationally. Gravitating matter, it just depends on its density. So you can supply that density with particles over a very broad range in mass. So there are candidates for dark matter particles that range in mass from 10 to the minus 4 eV to 10 to the minus 4 solar masses. And although Rotten Cold isn't here, I shouldn't fail to mention the WIMP SILA, a particular scheme which involves 10 to the 18th GeV particles, which are unobservable and very inaccessible, produced only in the earliest epoch of the universe, but nevertheless, if you're lucky, able to supply a reasonable amount of dark matter. But On the other hand, I think that there is a particular, not a particular particle, but a particular generic kind of model which is preferred among the scheme, which is the WIMP, which I will define in the next lecture. The one possible problem with the WIMP scenario, as far as we're concerned now, is whether dark matter particles have to have relatively large cross-sections, by this I mean in the microbar range, to explain some of the aspects of dark matter in the galaxy that astronomers argue. Most astronomers, I think, that I've polled believe that this is not necessary. However, some people, in particular Jeremiah Ostricker at Princeton, are very vocal that they believe it is necessary. And these kinds of cross-sections will not appear in the model, though. But with that, with only that difficulty, let me go ahead. Yes?
Just necessary to smooth out the cusped center if it's sometimes in dark matter simulations.
Is it necessary?
No. Is that their motivation for large cross-sections?
Well, that's right. They want to smooth out cuspy structures, which, frankly, we may or may not have evidence for.
Okay.
So, let me now talk about WIMP. So let me first define a WIMP. And not everyone gives this definition, but it's a good one for my physicists. A WIMP is a particle outside standard model of particle physics that's heavy, neutral, absolutely stable, and has interactions strong enough that by pair production and pair annihilation, it could have been in thermal equilibrium in the early universe. So this is very important. The WIMPzilla is produced in a non-equilibrium situation, and various heavy dark matter candidates are also produced in non-equilibrium situations. But if the dark matter particle was in equilibrium at some point, then there's a very well-defined procedure for figuring out how much of it there should be now. You start from thermal equilibrium, you run the Boltzmann equation. Assuming that you understand its interactions well enough, you can watch it annihilate. Eventually, you come to a temperature called the freeze-out temperature, where it's not back-produced anymore, but the universe keeps expanding, so the annihilation rate goes down as the universe expands. And eventually, you're left with some asymptotic density, which now has a very low annihilation rate and basically just expands away as the universe expands. Now, there are two reasons why I like WIMPs. First of all, WIMPs are the only dark matter candidates that appear naturally without knowing about WIMP physics in particle physics, including the specification of the mask. You could also say most of this for axions. But for axions, I think it's very difficult to understand why the mass scale has to be what it is. That comes from some cosmological constraints. For many WIMP models, of which I'll give you examples, actually other aspects of particle physics tell you what the mass should be at the correct level. So that goes under the name of don't trust an experiment until it is validated by theory. Something with which people in this building Secondly, if dark matter is a WIMP, we're going to have experimental constraints that could prove its identity and really discuss all aspects of its physics. And that's going to really be the main topic of this lecture. For other models, this is going to be very difficult. Once again, Larry Widrow, when I was at CETA, reminded me that for the axion, there's some very beautiful experimental handles that axions could be discovered. So maybe they should be accepted from this second visit. But this goes under the heading, God is subtle, but not malicious. So if you believe in these two statements, then I would say, modulo what I've said about axions, you have to believe in dark matter as a WIMP. And so from now on, I'm going to assume that. If that's not your favorite model, I apologize, but that's the end of the message. So now let me give you some basic formula for dark matter orientation. I'm not going to solve the Boltzmann equation exactly here. I'll use an approximation due to Turner and Sherrick, but it's good enough to at least get the orders of magnitude that we'll need for the rest of the case. First of all, I've talked about freeze-out, the temperature where the dark matter particles are stopping being pair-produced. So what temperature is that? Well, it turns out that rather robustly, you can estimate that temperature. And it turns out to be about 1/25th or 4% of the mc squared, the mass of the dark matter particle. So dark matter annihilation, the density is fixed when the particles are very non-localized. Then, with that estimate of the freeze-out temperature, you can then integrate to infinity the annihilation rate, and then you get an estimate for how much dark matter there is around at the presence of it. Expressed as an omega h squared, or omega times h squared is basically a half, you find the following formula in terms of the current entropy density of the universe, the closure density, the effective number of degrees of freedom at freeze out, the Planck scale, and the annihilation cross section. Now, all of these are quantities with large numbers in the exponent. I mean, you all know that there's 10 to the 19th in the exponent here. And I must say, I've forgotten 10 to the minus what in Rev C, the conventional units. But there are many orders of magnitude flying around in this equation. However, when you put in all the numbers, what you find is that omega h squared of 0.1, which is the value that's called for by the cosmic microwave background experiments, leads to a sigma v, which is 1 picogram. And for a particle physicist, 1 picogram is a very interesting number because it's a somewhat large, but not outrageously large, cross-section for the collider experiments of the next generation, the LHC and the next generation plus and minus colliders. So this statement tells us that something in nature, completely independently of how we think about what's going to happen next with elementary particle physics, something in astronomy is telling us that the mass scale that we're going to go into is more or less the right mass scale to find in physics. And if you make an estimate like this, that sigma b should be something like pi alpha squared over m squared, some conventional number on the denominator, you find that that mass is up about 100 GeV. Once again, the mass scale that will be accessed in the next generation. So,
does this assume that you have the same number of Wimpson arguments?
Yes.
When it's only symmetry, how does it change? Well, we know there's asymmetry in all the Max sections, so.
No, that's right.
In the
there is an asymmetry. The point is that there is, if there's an asymmetry, you have complete annihilation. If you have an asymmetry, then you often have, if the asymmetry is large enough, complete annihilation, down to some very small residual number of the ether. And so the question is the asymmetry large enough to produce a density larger than the one that I've indicated here? And in some models, that will be manifestly not true. In most of the models I'm going to discuss on the next few slides, there actually can't be an asymmetry because of some property of the model. For example, in supersymmetry, the dark matter particle is a Majorana particle. It's equivalent to its antiparticle. And then there can't be a physical difference in the density of particles and antiparticles. So that's true very often. If you engineer as with ordinary matter, so at this era, there's a 10 to the minus 10. Well, the difference between the number of quarks and antiquarks at this era is of order 10 to the minus 10. If you would have a similar difference between the number of Wimps and anti-Wimps, then this argument would be reached. Would not be much.
Would not be what?
Would not be much of that.
I have another question. So you're using the time structure constants in your scaling argument here.
Right. I'm
wondering why you're involved.
Let's see. I could use the fine structure constant, 1 over 137. I could use the weak interaction coupling constant, 1 over 30. I could use the strong interaction coupling constant, 1 over 9. It only affects some of the factor, not the order of magnitude.
Yeah, well, actually, you assume that these are neutral, so kind of putting in the fine structure constant is, doesn't sound all that healthy.
It's not a healthy process, so it should be the weak scale after anything, right?
But they're a weak leader. Okay, well, as I say, if I put 130th here instead of 1 over 137, then this number here would change by, okay, a factor 6 or something. So I assume that these particles interact through the known interactions of particle physics. At these scales, all of that, those, the, they're all described by dimensionless couplings, which are roughly the same. If you want this number to be 300 rather than 100, I'm not quite far away. So whether that number is 300 or 100, it's an amazing number, because it, in order of magnitude, which is all I actually claim to have done, it seems to coincide with the mass scale of the weak interactions and the vacuum expectation value. So particle physicists, I have said here in quotes, know that there is new physics at this general mass scale, because we have a problem on our side that the weak interactions are known, and in fact, there's very strong evidence for this to be a gauge theory of the group SU2 cross U1. In order to produce the phenomenology of the weak interactions, that gauge group must be spontaneously broken. We don't know what the mechanism is of spontaneous symmetry group, but if you try and make models of spontaneous symmetry group, you find yourself very rapidly led to introduce new kinds of particles, sometimes whole new sectors of particles, whose dynamics would then create the physics of that spontaneous symmetry. The mass scale of those particles is necessarily at this few hundred GeV scale. And so if another piece of physics points to that scale, it's natural to assume that those pieces of physics are connected, that their origin is in the same new fundamental interactions, which are required.
In that statement, are you counting Higgs as a new physics?
I'm counting Higgs as a new physics, although frankly, personally, I'm not a believer that with one Higgs field you can solve all the problems of electricity. But yes, the literal statement is, if it's a Higgs field, that's still the physics. And it absolutely is. We know nothing about the Higgs boson, except that it breaks the symmetry of the weak interactions. So the most famous example of a model that you would introduce to solve this problem is supersymmetry. And already, well back in the history of phenomenological supersymmetry, people proposed that supersymmetric models do explain the presence of cosmic darkness. So in 1983, papers by these people pointed out the existence in the theory of a stable, neutral particle weakly interacting, satisfying all the conditions that I laid down before, for a length of dark matter. The way it works is that there's a symmetry called R, which is the quark number, the lepton number, and twice the spin, which is very naturally conserved in supersymmetric models. Obviously, baryon number and lepton number have to be at least approximately good symmetries for those models. It's not so hard to make this quantity an exact symmetry. The quantity, however, is doctored so that ordinary particles are all R plus 1. However, in supersymmetry, the partners have spin differing by a half. So that then gives you R equals minus 1, and then it predicts that the lightest particle, which is the supersymmetric partner of a standard model particle, will be absolutely stable. If that particle is neutral, it's then with darker. And these guys talked about the partner of the photon as being a canonical example of weak dark matter, but actually there are many candidates. The photon, the neutral Higgs boson. Left-handed neutrinos give two large, probably direct detection cross-sections, but right-handed neutrinos are perfectly acceptable as additions to methods. But I would like to emphasize that supersymmetry isn't the only model that does that. Essentially, any model that you would make that has new physics at the few hundred GeV scale, something that, as I emphasize again, is something that you have to do to make a concrete model of electronic symmetry, If you add to that model, or if the model naturally possesses a discrete symmetry that keeps particles stable, then if that particle is neutral, it is a candidate for a limit gut. There are a bunch of examples from extra dimensions on this slide. So Fang and Lachev and Servan and Tate have looked at theories called universal extra dimensions, in which you add a fifth dimension, its size is h bar over TeV. You let all the standard model particles run in that dimension. The Kaluza-Klein excitations, the particles with finite momentum around that extra dimension, are heavy particles. Now, if that situation has a parity symmetry, reflection of the fifth dimension, then the lightest particle with odd parity is stable. It's very likely to be the particle that can have the photon, the right-hand neutrino, Higgs boson, something on that list. And then that particle could be moved up. In the Randall-Sundrum idea of warped extra dimensions, where you have some physics that lives on a brain, some fifth dimension with a constant negative curvature, it's a very interesting setup that I don't have time really to describe, in which the fundamental scale of physics changes from the TeV scale at one end of the world to the Planck scale at the other end. There's a problem in those models of having grand unification. The problem is that if you try to put a grand unification near the Planck scale, some degrees of freedom from that theory can wander over to the other brain, which is at the TeV scale, and mediate proton decay with TeV masses instead of Planck masses, thus giving much too high rates of proton decay. Servant and Tate suggest, Agasha and Servant suggested that one can remove that problem by assigning a Z3 parity to representations of the grand unified theory. That takes the particles which have odd baryon number, colored particles with zero baryon number, and gives them some quantity so that they can't mediate proton decay. But it also means that a particle with the quantum numbers of the neutrino is rendered absolutely stable. Nelson and Katz have suggested that you can also use R parity to simplify. And finally, there's a model of large extra dimensions of Arkady-Hamed, Demopoulos, and Bolland. In that model, all matter lives on a brain. There's a larger universe, but only gravity lives there. In that model, however, the brain fluctuations, if the brain is somehow pinned to a certain point, can be heavy neutral particles, which are weakly interacting. If one has a parity symmetry about the brain, they get a quantum number, so they're absolutely stable. And they would be a kind of ring dark matter that these guys call ringlets.
But then if you would start from the weak scale temperatures, you will only produce all these codes like Klein gravitons, etc. Usually we cannot start with anything hotter than the NDV or something.
Oh,
yeah.
But please excuse me. The freeze-out temperatures that we're talking about are GeV.
That's right.
That's
good. If you start from those freeze-out temperatures, you would normally overproduce.
Okay.
Well, please, in most of the models,
please excuse me. I mean, if you can't make a realizable universe out of it, then we can forget it. But to the extent that you can make a realizable universe out of these models, you only need to go up to a GeV to have the physics I'm talking about. And I'm not wedded to any of these models. I just want to point out that anytime you make a model of electric symmetry breaking, there are discrete symmetries around which you can apply to get rid of dark temperatures. So in some sense, there's a generic scenario. There are a very large number of specific theories that fit in this scenario. We'd like to test them collectively, and then we have to go find out which ones. So let's first talk about the collective testing. So I exclude this Brayman model, maybe for good reason. And in all of the other models, the new sector that I've introduced has not only the wind, but it also has another particle carrying the same discrete quantum number as the wind, but also having QCD interactions, color triplet or sometimes color octet. Such particles can be produced in pairs in gluon-gluon collisions, and in particular, if I have enough energy at the LHC. Such particles then decay to the dark matter particle, which is the lightest particle in this sector, the sector of particles carrying this quantum. So a typical decay process through several stages might look like this, where I have a quark, or maybe an extra quark in that quark pair, and maybe some leptons, etc. The initial mass of the particle are many hundreds of GeV, but the final state is a few hundred GeV, so the energies of those quark and lepton jets are also at the 100 GeV scale. So we end up with extremely characteristic events. Missing the many, because the WIMPs go off in random directions and are unobserved by particle physics detectors. Plus, jets of hadrons from the quarks or isolated leptons from the leptons. The cross sections for pair production of this colored particle, first of all, is rather model independent. It has only a small dependence on the spin. It mainly has a small strong dependence on the mass of the particle. And for masses below 1 TeV, the cross sections are rather large. They're tens or sometimes hundreds of picoelectrons. And if you ask what this translates to in terms of the number of these events that you produce at the LHC, you can look at this diagram, which was made by the Atlas collaboration at the LHC in the case of supersymmetry. So supersymmetry, as some of you know, at least has an enormous parameter space. This is an attempt to simplify by taking two canonical parameters of supersymmetry. I don't think I'll even explain to you what they are, except they're some representative masses of the new particles of supersymmetry. Probably what's more interesting is to look at the contours of masses where the partner of the quark or the partner of the gluon has a constant amount. So here we have contours of constant squark masses. And this is 500, 1 TeV, 1500, and 2 TeV from this group. Here we have contours of constant gluino mass, 500 GeV, 1 TeV, 1.5, and 2 up there. And then drawn across these are the contours where the LHC would see a significant signal for events with missing energy plus multi-jets. And the top contour, labeled 10 in perspective lines, is the first year design luminosity event sample for the LHC. And the bottom line here is 1% of that. And if you look closely on this, you'll see that that line completely encloses the region where one of the superparticles, the squark or the gluino, is below a TeV, which is the most probable region. And in fact, as I pointed out, these cross sections don't really depend on the model, they just depend on the masses and the color quantities. So this is a very robust. Here's the kind of signal you would see, I think, for a 1 TeV gluino, 10 in perspective lines. Here I'm plotting a quantity called M effective, which is the missing energy plus the total energy in jets. Processes that produce M effective large from the standard model are, for example, top quark production, where a neutrino or two neutrinos go off unobserved. Those give an event sample that you see is very rapidly falling as this variable gets large. You see many orders of magnitude on the left in this plot. And the supersymmetry signal from the model I've discussed is far above them, corresponding to hundreds or sometimes thousands of events per day. So, as I said, a very robust signal. It is very likely that the first thing we will learn from the LHC is that the LHC is producing a particle that is a good candidate for the term. Yes?
But supposing there wasn't the stable dark matter when but there was still the strongly coupled particle that would be there, you would see the same missing energy. How do you know that the final state is a WIMP rather than something that looked at outside the detector decays to some bunch of junk?
We don't know that. That's why I said candidate, I didn't say WIMP.
Okay.
Much more.
You're absolutely right.
So now what we have to do is to ask, what have we learned
And then what do we have to do next? If Lee is a little ahead where I am of that question. So we've learned that unobservable particles that live for some short time are produced. By analyzing these events kinematically, you can learn their mass to about 10%. So now what we'd like to do is to ask, well, we've learned already that to get the right relative density of dark matter in the universe, we need an annihilation cross-section of about a picomolar. Can we establish that from microscopic measurements? And the answer is that that is actually a very tough question. Obviously, it is not so easy to learn the annihilation cross-section of an unobservable particle. The only way to do it is to figure out, first of all, qualitatively what the particle is, to define some particular theory in which you can prove that it lives, and then to measure the parameters of that theory as well as you can, at least the ones that are relevant to the annihilation cross-section and other properties of that particle that you might need to do astrophysics. And so let's talk a little about that. So, something that you very often hear is that the discovery of missing energy at ELHC would be proof of supersymmetry. And I try to argue, maybe Maxine will disagree with me, that that is not correct, because there are many other schemes in which supersymmetry is only one that lead to the same signature at this level. So what you have to do then is to try and figure out from more detailed properties of the events which of these schemes is the correct one. The purpose of this diagram is to demonstrate that that is a very non-trivial thing to do. So I remind you that the LHC is proton-proton collisions. The mechanism for producing new particles is that a quark or a gluon of a proton will collide with a quark or a gluon of the other proton, producing heavy particles, which in turn decay, and the decays include on each side of the event an unobserved quark. So there is unknown momentum going in, at least you know what axis it goes in on. There's unknown momentum coming out, and there the axis is totally undefined. And then you have to take the particles that you can observe and try and put a picture together. It's an extraordinarily difficult problem. So I've shown here four models of dark matter among the ones that I've discussed before, models where the photino, or if you like, the neutralino, lightest neutral gauge particle in supersymmetry is the dark matter particle, where a right-handed neutrino particle might be the dark matter particle. Or universal extra dimension models, where the same two particles appear. The cross-sections for producing these particles at the LHC are, if not identical, very simple. And in fact, because the mass of these particles is not well known, probably the same between the errors. The visible products are the quark and two leptons, and then three quarks, or q bar, or something like that, will be seen on the other side. The last particle here is always unobserved, as are all the neutrinos. So it's just an extraordinarily difficult problem to figure out which of these models you're in. If you could measure the spins of any particle along the line, it would be quite characteristic. So, for example, an intermediate stage here, and that goes so high, here you have a particle which is a spin-a-half particle with lepton. If you could identify that particle, it would argue very strongly that you're in this one of the four choices. But spin measurements, there are some observables at the LHC that are sensitive to spin, but I don't think anyone is claiming you can measure the spin of a new particle at the LHC. The kinematics just is not local. For that, you really need a different kind of tool. And the tool you need is one that can go very directly to the spin and electron quantum numbers of the particles that are carrying this new discrete signature. And the ideal tool there really is E plus or minus annihilation. So let me just show you, for the case of the first and the third models on the slide that I had a moment ago, I said that if you could identify that a certain particle had lepton number and spin a half, it would pick out that scenario. Here's the case where it has spin a half. This is now the cross-section, the total cross-section from threshold, the simplest observable you can imagine. Here's the case where it has spin zero.
There's a qualitative distinction. There's also a qualitative distinction in the angular distribution with which these particles are produced. That, as you know, is always a direct indicator of spin in these simple particle physics reactions. There's also a qualitative distinction in the decay distribution. This one has a decay distribution that is flat in decay angle because it's a spin zero particle. This one gets a polarization. And so you can see that the decay distribution is not flat in angle. And actually, you can even interpret the slope to help you understand what's happening. So if you like the, if you can access these scales in your plus and minus collisions, then just absolutely the first thing that you measure will allow you to qualitatively identify what model you're. And then from there, we can go on and ask what we do. So now, having qualitatively identified the model, one would like to now go to the next step. Can we quantitatively account for the cosmic density by measuring the annihilation constant? And this is a somewhat trickier problem. Again, the particle is invisible. We can't collide these particles themselves. We have to take what information is given us by nature or in our study of these particles in accelerators. We have to collect the masses and couplings that contribute in the theory that we have picked out to the annihilation process. And this is actually quite untrue. The relative density depends on the annihilation cross-section, but the annihilation cross-section is very model-dependent. But fortunately, the annihilation cross-section often depends most strongly on the light states of the theory. So at least if we can get to them, we can assemble a lot of the information. And so this, again, is a place where E plus E minus collisions come in a very strong way, because if you can get to the relevant mass scale, even just barely to get to the physics of the lightest particle, you can make precision measurements and try and determine its mass and its couplings to other states. So now, there's a little coda here, which actually we would be interested in. I was planning to run to 3:15. Is it okay if I run a little over and give you this or share it with us?
I think we have a pretty rapt audience that may disagree with letting me run a little longer.
This code is kind of neat. Should microscopic calculations of the negative square agree with the cosmic graph? Well, there are various reasons why it, we would love it if it did. This is what happens in primordial nucleosynthesis. The microscopic calculation agrees with what we see in the universe. And people think that that's fantastic, and they use the small deviations to bound late entropy production and such things. If there were disagreement, it would argue that there's some late decay, late entropy production, where by late I mean a time of order 10 to the minus 7 or 10 to the minus 6 seconds after the Big Bang. But there's another mechanism, which Lee alluded to, for why the relic density that comes from a microscopic determination might not equal the one which occurred, which you find in the universe. And that is, if the particle that you produce in accelerators then decays to a lighter particle, which is even more uncertain, and which is the true dark matter. So this, for example, happens in supersymmetry if the neutralino can decay, or if another supersymmetric particle can decay to the gravitino, which then only interacts with gravitational strain. So then you get a formula like this. If you can calculate this microscopically, and then you can measure the mass ratio between the particle you produce and the so-called supermin that it decays to, then you can do something. Well, several people, but in particular, Feng, Takayama, Rajaraman, and Smith, studied this scenario. They argued that the neutralino decaying to a gravitino actually doesn't work, because the late decay basically deposits too much entropy and disrupts primordial nucleosynthesis. However, there is a little window where you can live with a stable lepton, so-called slepton, and have that decay to the gravitino. The lifetime for the expert supergravity-mediated supersymmetry breaking is roughly 1 year. In this scenario, all astrophysical searches for dark matter fit, because the dark matter particle is a gravity particle with extremely weak interactions. However, the slepton here looks at colliders like a stable particle. And so you would see this stable particle coming out of your experiments at the LHC, at the Linear Collider, and you can measure its mass. Well, now something else happens, which is quite neat. At a Linear Collider, which operates near the threshold of these particles, you can actually get enough material to slow them down and capture them, for example, in a large water tank that you would put outside the detector. At the LHC, most of them actually just have too much energy. They can't lose enough energy, and they just escape from Geneva and are never seen. But if you can get close enough to threshold, you can try to collect them. And then you put the water somewhere underground, and you wait. And when it decays to a lepton and a gravitina, you measure the energy of that lepton. Spontaneously broken supersymmetry makes a precise prediction about this. There's an equation that relates the lifetime, which comes from the coupling of the slepton to the gravitina, the Planck scale, which comes from supergravity, and the mass of the gravitina, which is acquired by the super-Higgs mechanism. So there's a precise equation. If you can measure everything in it, you can check and see if it's true. And I've just given you, I've just shown you that you can collect all the data to verify whether or not that experiment is true. Here's some estimate of how many of these things you would produce. So you see thousands at typical running energies of a Linear Collider. And by the way, because you've measured the mass of the gravitino, you can also go back and check the equation properly. So we couldn't do this in astrophysics, but in this particular scenario, we could really find out that this is the origin of the cosmic. Okay, that's the end of the little coda. Let me now get back to the mainstream. Now I'd like to focus on more conventional supersymmetry models, in particular models where the dark matter candidate is the neutral unit, the partner of the photon and Z, or some mixture of those things with Higgs bosons. And I'd like to ask whether in those well-understood models, one can realistically predict the dark matter. So now the study of these questions brings us into the intricacies of phenomenological supersymmetry. And so, what else do we need to do? So the simplest situation is that the neutralino would be the supersymmetric partner of the lightest gauge particle in the standard model. So, for example, the U1 gauge frozen of SU2+U1. Let's call it the beam. In that situation, dark matter annihilates by a slepton exchange to lepton pairs, or similarly by spark exchange to quark pairs. But there's a problem with this, which was actually pointed out by Goldberg in one of those very early articles that I referred to a little while ago. Neutralinos are Majorana particles. They obey Fermi statistics. Therefore, this state of annihilation in the S wave, where the thumb indicates my spin direction, the spin direction, does not exist. They must annihilate in a spin zero state. The leptons come out in a spin zero state, but relativistic leptons like to come out with the lepton left-handed and the anti-lepton right-handed. So that would be a state of spin helicity 1. So annihilation of the S wave is basically forbidden, except maybe for bottom quarks. And the leading term of annihilation is in the P wave. For the P wave, that formula that I showed you before actually has an extra factor of 8 in it. So you need 8 times larger cross-sections. And just when you put in the numbers, it doesn't work. So here's a little example. A random slice through parameter space of supersymmetry. The numbers are the mass of the neutralino. Here is the mass of the lightest lepton partner in the theory. Over here you have omega h squared. Here's the cosmic value. And you can see that as soon as the superparticles get all heavy, it just ceases to work. You can move these curves around by wandering around the parameter space, but the qualitative conclusion is actually much. It's interesting. In the 1980s, we thought that omega for dark matter was 1, we thought that sleptons would have masses of tens of GeV, and then it would work perfectly. But nowadays, we know that omega is 0.2, we know that sleptons are, have masses greater than 100 GeV. And this picture doesn't work anymore unless the sleptons are really pushed down to very close to the point where to the saturation. And so, to get the right relic density within supersymmetry, we either have to go to that region, or we have to go to some other region where the annihilation cross-section is enhanced in some way. And so, on this slide, I have a little map of where those regions might be from, I guess, John Ellis' collaboration. So the point I referred to before is down here, somewhere in this parameter space. There are various other scenarios that you can imagine to increase the annihilation cross-section while still tolerating heavier particle masses. But in each of those scenarios, the regions in which you get the right dark matter density are quite special. And to check that, you have to do very accurate microscopic measurements. So here's a list of scenarios that one can find. The top one I've already discussed. The second one, I won't try and explain where the name comes from, but the physics is that you annihilate to W, the neutralinos para-annihilate to W's and Z's. That cannot occur for a pure beta. It requires that the gauge partners mix with the Higgs partners, and the annihilation cross-section depends strongly on that mixing. Next is what's called the co-annihilation. In that region, you have small mass differences between the neutralino and the lepton partners, the sleptons, such that at the low temperatures that establish the relic density, the sleptons are still in thermal equilibrium. Then the dominant cross-sections are actually the annihilation cross-sections of the sleptons, which are not helicity suppressed. However, in order for the sleptons to have a reasonable density, they have to be quite close in mass to the neutralino. And in fact, there's a Boltzmann factor, an exponential dependence on the mass difference that comes into the formula for the annihilation cross-section. And finally, there's a resonance in the Higgs sector of supersymmetry models called the A boson, which is CPR. So that has the property that you can actually have resonant annihilation of neutralinos in this spin state through that boson. And so if you move the A to the right place, you can use that resonance to enhance the annihilation cross-section. But, of course, it depends on the A being right where you said it should be, and so you then have to measure that dependence to find out what the annihilation cross-section is. So now what we'd like to do is, well, is it actually realistic to make measurements that are accurate enough that you can supply this data? And so a number of people have looked at this, in particular the study group, some of these members I listed on the first slide, decided to take this on to define a bunch of these points to actually do some collider simulation studies of how well measurements could be made and then try to feed that back into the relevance. And so I'd just like to present some still preliminary results of the study. Mainly, for clarity, I'll focus on number two, point two, which is in the focus. So there, the squarks and sleptons are quite heavy. Basically, there are four parameters, which are parameters of the Gaugenos and Higgsinos that determine the physics. We'd like to make at least four precision measurements to determine these parameters correctly. And so let's talk a little about the physics of neutralino annihilation in this case, and ask where these parameters come from. So, here is the process of a neutralino annihilation to W bosons. Once again, the process is that the Gaugeno turns into a Higgsino, which then has a very large cross-section to annihilate it to W bosons. And so the problem is to get a good measurement of this mixing to determine the cross-section. That could come then from measurements of the mass spectrum in the physics, or from measurements of cross-sections. Actually, a very interesting reaction, and one which it turns out is easy to study on what it shows, is where you pair produce the second and third neutralino. In that case, this reaction is very sensitive to those mixing levels. And in particular, if you have right-handed polarized electrons, the reaction doesn't go unless you have an exponent. We'll pair produce these particles, and then we'll observe their cascade decays to the lightest neutrino, which is the unobservable dark matter. The cascades will produce jet pairs or lepton pairs. You could also have the charged partner of this guy, which would decay to a jet pair or lepton neutrino. The events are very characteristic and very beautiful in the plus and minus environment. And so here is a Chargino pair production, where on one side you get two jets that are very clearly seen in this figure. On the other side, we decay to two unobserved particles plus a positron. The positron is not so impressive, but this is a huge energy deposition to those who can hide these pictures. And so all properties of this reaction that are observable can be very successful. So looking now at the reaction E plus E minus to N2N3, we have this result of the simulations done by the Cornell group, Jim Alexander and his colleagues. So what do you see here? You see, going back, to here, you see the cascade decay from here to here making a dileptic. Or the cascade decay from here to here. Those should give you two very sharply defined kinematic endpoints, and you see them here and here. Now, Maxime was close enough that he can see a black line that goes through the data up here and down that side. That is the detailed predicted shape of the mass distribution in supersymmetry, which actually, once you fix the endpoints, has no free parameters. Actually, it has one free parameter. I'll give you an exercise. The shape depends on the relative sign of the mass eigenvalue of the neutralino mass eigenvalues. So if the neutralino mass matrix has three positive and one negative eigenvalue, it says that the number two neutralino has a positive eigenvalue and the number three neutralino has a negative eigenvalue, which you know is true. So actually, the detailed shape of this curve is a very interesting check that the underlying model is supersymmetric. The precision with which the endpoints can be measured is also quite impressive. You see where the parts per million level is. And then if you ask how that translates onto the dark matter problem, well, you measure two neutralino masses, a Chargino mass, two cross sections in each of which are two polarizations. You get a spread of points for the relative density that looks like this. The last cut made in a scan of parameter space that Marco Vitali made is on the Chargino versus neutralino mass difference. That's measured according to the results of the study to a couple hundred MeV. That corresponds to this error band, which then is compared to this line in the error band of W for the relevance. And it's quite interesting. You can get there, but you have to really pull out all the stops. And in particular, you have to have this part per mil accuracy in particle mass determinations. Let me just point out that part per mil accuracy in particle mass determinations is a more general expectation for the linear collider experiments. Here's a study done by the University of Colorado group. Those of you, at least in the front, can see that there are actually two spectra here which correspond to the lepton energy from slepton. Ideally, it's a box-like diagram like this. It's rounded by some experimentation effects, which are well understood. If you change the parameters of the theory by 1.5%, it changes the gray region to the blue curve. And hopefully most of you in the room can visibly see that change. And so by careful measurements, you can actually discriminate differences that are at the part per mil. And once again, that's what we need in order to get a good enough relative density to compare with astrophysics. So these are preliminary results of some scans that Marco and Vitaly and I are still doing for the minimal supersymmetric standard model. But roughly, we're getting a few percent accuracy in the scenario number one, a few percent that I showed you in the scenario number two, but more like 10% in the co-annihilation scenario. It's just hard to measure that very small mass difference. And the eight funnel scenario, again, something like polysaurus. So if indeed we could find agreement or even sharp disagreement between measurements, microscopic predictions of the relative density of this accuracy, and cosmic measurements, which are now and will be after the Planck satellite or comparable accuracy, that would be tremendous information in terms of trying to understand whether we really know the particle's origin. Now, finally, let me take a few minutes to discuss. Finally, I'd like to just take a few minutes to discuss very briefly the implications for electric physical structures. So before I wrote down this formula for the gamma ray flux, which depended, as I said, on unknown densities of dark matter particles and on unknown cross-sections. Now, with the data that I've shown you how to get, the unknown cross-sections become known, or they become predicted by this model at the level of 5% or sometimes a few percent. Let me now discuss the implication of that, of rewriting this formula and showing you some pictures associated. So it's conventional to really factorize this formula between the astrophysical and particle physics quantities. And that's done here. The mass of the neutrino comes in because I have to convert a number density to a measured mass density. But this quantity is predicted to parts, is measured to parts per million experiments that I described. So it's not much of an answer. Here are some canonical astrophysical values. J is a dimensionless measure of the depth of an object, for example, the galactic center in dark. And a canonical estimate for this would be to take a 1 picobon cross-section, such as we need from the relative density, multiply by 3 gamma rays per unit of logarithmic energy, multiply by C, and then you get this in nice astrophysics units with a large exponent, and now you can try and do something. So now we have to take that temporarily determined cross-section and combine it with some theory of the distribution of dark matter in the galaxy. So if you open up a paper on the astrophysical detection of dark matter, or you look in the protein DARC-SUSY, codifies some of these papers, you find various models for how dark matter is distributed toward the center of the galaxy. And I've shown them here. They are widely variant within a couple of kiloparsecs of the galaxy. If you integrate over a small disk around the galactic center, you get the integral of this dimensionless J quantity. And I've plotted it here for the 4 models as a function of the angular size of the disk. Using the canonical cross-section estimates, I've plotted the power of various gamma ray observatories that we expect in the near future. You can see that those observatories are powerful or not, depending upon whether the estimates I gave for the cross-section are correct or not to order of magnitude. In particular, if they're right, and if these folks are right, this point will establish very significant upper limits. If the cross sections are much lower, then we might not understand whether, if this fellow doesn't see a signal, it's an upper limit or just a failure of the particle. And so, how reliable is that cross section estimate that I made on the previous slide? As a one-line argument, it's fantastic. It takes the measured density of dark matter in the universe, and it translates it into a physical cross-section that I can use for detection. But the translation is not that simple. The cross-section of the early universe is measured at a temperature of GeV, of 4% of the dark matter mass. In the universe, dark matter particles are really cold, and they really annihilate at threshold. If there's a substantial P-wave contribution to that cross-section in the earlier population, or a co-annihilation contribution from some other heavy particle, those things are totally gone. And so then we get the results that I'll show on the next slide that Ted Balls was kind enough to make for me for these four scenarios. So here are the properly normalized gamma ray and positron spectra for the four scenarios. In the where it annihilates the W bosons or annihilates through the A boson, we can see that that estimate that I gave is more or less right, maybe even a little low. The 10 to the 1 there is the 10 to the minus 26 that I quoted on the previous slide. Here, though, the annihilation, when we established the relic density, was dominantly P wave, so it's gone away. And here, much of the annihilation came from co-annihilation. And as you see, this value is about an order of magnitude lower than the value that you see over here. So we'd like to know how these spectra are normalized and exactly where the endpoints are before we try and draw conclusions from astrophysical gamma research. And as I've said, that data is coming from particle physics, but somehow it needs to be supplied in order to interpret the results of this experiment. Now, all the gamma ray spectra are roughly of the same shape, but the positron spectra actually are different. In this case, one can make use of the fact that a W boson, which is a direct product of the annihilation, can then decay directly to a positron. And that leads to that little shelf that you see at the very high energy edge of the distribution. Ted Balls said, well, I can run that through my code for astrophysical positron detection, propagated through the galaxy, and I predict from that a positron spectrum, which looks like the red line that I've shown on this curve. Now, this is a very interesting illustration of some things that I said at the very beginning of the talk. The green line is an a priori estimate of the galactic background of high-energy positron. It falls smoothly because we don't know anything about it, so we assume it falls. data is from an experiment called HEAP that measured high-energy positrons in the balloon experiment. When you add the green curve to the red curve, you get the black curve, which is actually a fabulously good fit to that data. The blue curve is a structureless alternative hypothesis that you see is deviated by many standard deviations. Is this a discovery or not? Well, unfortunately, it would be nice to see if this data goes down at high energies, but HEAP experiment didn't go up that far. Sometime in the future, AMS and Pamela, I think, will supply data. There's one more thing I need to tell you about Balz's fit. The dark matter annihilation cross-section, of course, is higher if dark matter is clumpy. And so you can use the parameter, the mean density squared divided by the density squared, to enhance any signal. And so to get this fit, he actually cranked this parameter up to a value of 200, which he said, well, I'm an expert in these things, and in our community, that's perfectly acceptable. In universal extra dimensions, there's another mechanism for making a signal like this, where dark matter annihilates directly to electron-positron. Then instead of a shelf at the endpoint, you get a delta function. And then you get a very similar looking signal for B equals 1. So is it an anomaly? Is it a signal? Is dark matter clumpy or not? Everything depends on knowing the underlying particle physics. And I think if we can get there, we can figure out whether things like this are signals or just ephemera. Whether we can trust results like this, or whether we just have to say, well, let's wait for a better experiment. I just have one more comment on direct detection. There's a similar story there that I obviously don't have time to tell. Let me just say that for LCC2, that's the prediction. And you see that compared to the sensitivities of CDMS various versions. So, whether or not a signal that they see or an upper limit is a significant signal, again, depends on the particle physics. If you knew that, you could have. Okay, well, that's the end. My conclusion is, first of all, the WIMP models are interesting because there's a lot you can say. In 20 years, we could really know whether they're right or not. We could know all details of the structure of the WIMP. then we could know a lot about where the limb is in the universe. And I think that is a very interesting goal for particle physicists and astrophysicists to shoot for. To do that, we need certain things from the particle physics. We need to, first of all, observe dark matter as missing energy at a collider. We need to determine qualitatively, again, from microscopic data, what the model is that contains that dark matter. We then need to determine whether that model quantitatively explains the relatives by making all kinds of mass and coupling constant measurements to fantastic accuracy. And then we have to bring that information back to astrophysical dark matter purification. The LHC, I've argued, is not sufficient, but with future E plus E minus experiments also will do very well. And I think we can get there. And so, well, I'll come back sometime and tell you what we have. Thank you very much.
I have one quick question. Conversely, with only the LHC, will we not be able to be assured that supersymmetry has been discovered or not?
I believe quite strongly that we will not, with only the LHC, be assured that supersymmetry has been discovered or not. I think, well, in particular, there are papers, I mean, in particular, Maciek, Chang, and Schmaltz have argued this quite strongly. These universal extra dimension models can actually be tuned to resemble supersymmetry models as well as you like. There are very small discrepancies. It's not known whether, really, by exploring the parameter space, you can even widespread it. But those guys made themselves the task of generating a model that would mimic supersymmetry, but with completely different assignments of spins. And they succeeded to a very great extent. And it still needs more study, but it's an extraordinary.
Any other questions? Well, Michael's here only today this time, but we hope that he comes back. I want to thank you very much.